Hello and welcome to the Astana International Financial Center's Legal Tech Podcast with your host, Mark Beer.
Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome today three leaders, global leaders, when it comes to legal technology and particularly how legal technology intersects with data and regulation. And if I may introduce the speakers for today's webinar in no particular order, we'll start with Jennifer Swallow, who is the director of LawTech UK, part of TechNation in the United Kingdom, a body designed to promote the United Kingdom as a leader in technology and particularly in legal technology. I'll introduce Sally Sverre-Tate, the CEO of Regulation, an absolutely fantastic name. If you're looking her up online, it's Regulation with AI in the middle, Regulation. And lastly, Tyra Waters, head of Ashurst Advanced Digital. It's a pleasure to have you all here today.
It's a pleasure to be here today.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
Excellent. Well, perhaps I could start by asking you, Jennifer. You're going to change the world. TechNation is going to lead the UK to being the most advanced nation when it comes to technology, and particularly legal technology. Tell us what it's all about, how far you've got, and where the opportunities lie.
Correct, Mark. Well said. So LawTech UK was initiated to really start to bring a cohesive focus for the UK around all the amazing activity that is actually going on in this space already. So the UK market on LawTech is the second in the world in terms of activity and size, growing 101% in the last 3 years, which is faster than any other applied tech sector in the UK. So that includes climate tech, health tech, fintech, and all the others. So something's going on, but there was an acknowledgement that there's a real pertinent moment happening. And there's a real need to come together around common challenges, common opportunities, and really seize the day, essentially. So that is what LawTech UK is about, and that's the task that TechNation took on. Now, transformation of legal and court services is not going to happen in 2 years, which is our initial phase. So we're 18 months in. So what we've been focusing on is building foundations, proofs of concept, bringing people together. And it's been a fantastic first 18 months. So we had a four-pillar work program, which we can talk about. But one stream of that is around data. And obviously, there's a huge opportunity here around data, which I think is acknowledged globally and across sectors. And what's very clear to us is that whilst there's a lot of talk, there isn't really a lot of action in terms of what the legal community is doing. So in the UK, 80% of lawyers say that their organisation does not capture data effectively. Another 80% of general counsels say they are not confident in their ability to identify and manage risk, which I find is a terrifying statistic, absolutely terrifying as a general counsel myself. 86% of law firms want analytics, but only 18% are investing. And actually on investment, sort of tech investment more broadly and investment in R&D, the average of investment levels in terms of revenue for legal businesses is less than 1%. Now, the average investment level for businesses as a whole is 5%+. And, you know, you can go up to 10, 20, 30, 40, depending on the sector. So legal has a way to go, and there are a range of huge opportunities and huge imperatives, really, in respect of data, which perhaps is evidenced a little through those statistics. And there's a lot more we can go into, but that's really the sort of grounding for the work stream that we've been focusing on as regards data. Now, there's a couple of stems to that, which perhaps I can just draw out before I stop talking. The first is around access to data for people to build advanced tech. This is what we consistently hear when we talk to the law tech and tech community, is that they can't get access to the data that they need to train their tools. So one of the things we did when we initiated the Law Tech Sandbox at Law Tech UK, which is an R&D environment to support the accelerated development of transformative tech, one of the things we did was to try to respond to that. So one of the primary things that you get when you come into the LawTech Sandbox is access to data, or at least that's our goal. So we were very surprised, actually, in the pilot for the sandbox, the amount of yeses that we were getting in respect of people saying, yes, we are happy to partner with these incredible innovators, and we're happy to share data of various kinds with them so that they can train their tooling and so that we can get the advancement and opportunity of that tooling. So there's this piece around data matchmaking, right? Bilateral data sharing between parties. And that's something, again, it was a surprise success. We've built on that. And actually, if you look on the lawtechuk.io website, you will find a data sharing toolkit, which essentially gifts out the things that were learned during that pilot and the things that the people who did matchmake data successfully, what they followed. So hopefully that's a path to success for others. So that was 60%, 67% of people that applied to the sandbox wanted data. And we have a range of examples we can go into if useful of people who are doing that now in the sandbox in the current cycle. The second thing, though, is the wider issue, which I indicated through the statistics, of people in the legal sector just not using, capturing, maximizing their own data. And then as a collective, us not sharing it in a responsible way together. So what's our sort of medical research opportunity? What's the equivalent of that in legal services, right? If you were able to come together and pool insights of different kinds, what would those opportunities be and how could we do that? So that's the second element, the second strand to mention really around LawTech UK's work, which is sector commitment. So we brought a group of people together, a working group and a steering group. Sector commitments is the goal across a couple of use cases. If we were to identify steps that we can actually take together collectively, what would they be? And because we've got the regulatory response unit that we gathered together, so all the legal services regulators, of which there are way too many in the UK, and the Financial Conduct Authority and the Data Protection Regulator, we can present to them, kick the tires on these standards and potentially move away some of the impediments that either are in fact standing in the way or are just creating fear, but in fact are not real. And so we can move them out of the way. So a few things there, Mark, just to kick off.
Thank you very much. My goodness, it's been what an 18 months it's been, Jennifer. That's superb. And I like the comment that you made that a lot of people are talking about data and regulation and law tech, but not that many are doing it. Perhaps I can turn to you, Sally, because you are very much at the heart of looking at these issues and being involved in these issues. And tell us a little bit about what caused you to create regulation and what you're doing and how that intersects with law tech and data.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. So by way of background, I'm a defector. I defected from law and I became a technologist. So by way of background, I was general counsel, I was head of compliance, I was a regulator, and I was a partner at Clyde & Co. And my journey into technology began through my legal work. So I was the assistant general counsel who was in charge of treasury and investments in a bank in-house when Lehman happened. And you don't really know the journey that you're on until you look backwards. So it's very difficult to know what journey you're on when you're looking forward. But looking back on that journey, that experience when Lehman happened, we had to redo all of the systems of the bank. We had to, it's all of the capturing of the data, of the trading data, and you've got usually front office, middle office, and back office. We had to redo all of that. The existing relationships, what contract we had in place, what exposures we had in place. And it was very obvious that there wasn't enough data being captured. And whatever data was being captured wasn't really being used because it wasn't structured in a way that could be used. And I became a regulator after that experience when regulators were starting to impose more data obligations. Give us more data, give us more data. And it was very obvious that the regulators couldn't cope with that amount of data. At least it was obvious to me at the time. And Mark, you'll remember we met at that time. You and I were both on the regulator side. And after a few years, I worked, and we were part of the UCL, because I'm also an associate professor at UCL, and together with my co-founders from regulation, we worked on regulatory reporting with the FCA and the Bank of England, and we developed the first blockchain infrastructure that showed the regulators that it was possible to report digitally in a more efficient way. And through that experience, when everybody was talking about, we need to report better, we need better data, actually, what they weren't saying is that they need better analytics. So we talk about data as being the need, but the need really is management information, it's better analytics, it's you know, better what Jennifer was saying, 96%, is it 90%? 90% of GCs can't identify and manage risk. That's a staggering number. That is a really, really scary number. Actually, what they're saying isn't we need more data. What they're saying is we need more analytics. We need better management information. But you're never going to get better management information and you're never going to get better analytics until you have sorted out how you're going to access that data. And in a true lawyer fashion, we started peeling the onion and getting down to, with the tears that come with peeling an onion, obviously, and getting to the root of what is the root cause of that problem. And we eventually settled on developing an infrastructure, which is a decentralized data infrastructure, which allows, we call it collaborative analytics, but when we talk about collaborative analytics, I have to explain what I mean. Collaborative analytics could be within a single company. It could be two departments within a company collaborating together, and each of their data is stored in different systems. That's still collaborative analytics. The traditional way of doing things is that you take the data out of those systems and you centralize it somewhere. And then once you've centralized it somewhere, you then can do analytics. And we think that's highly inefficient. Why do you have to move the data? Keep the data where it is. And so we developed an infrastructure that does exactly that. A happy byproduct of that approach is that you're no longer sharing data. So we've reversed the approach where it's the algorithm that goes to the data and not the data to the algorithm. And with that, you preserve privacy. You're more efficient in how you're deploying your analytics. You get results quicker. There's a whole host of benefits that come from that. And so that's what we do. Jennifer and LawTech and Tech Nation, our journeys intersected through that approach because, you know, Jennifer's on the journey of enabling the legal system. We're on a journey of enabling all analytics. Some of it happens to also be in the legal because, you know, frankly, this is where my background is. And so the other percentage that I think Jennifer was quoting was that 86% of lawyers want better legal tech. Well, they're never going to get better legal tech if they don't give access to data, because at the end of the day, legal tech needs to learn from data to get better. So that's our journey and that's why we exist.
How fantastic. So we've got an absence of data and an absence, even if we had data, of ability to analyze it, and the lack of investment, it seems, Jennifer, from what you're saying, by law firms in technology. Now, Tara, you're head of Ashurst Advanced Digital, so it would perhaps appear that Ashurst are way ahead of many other law firms in investing in this sector. Tell us a bit more about it and tell us your views on law tech, and particularly data and regulation and how they intersect.
Well, I mean, first of all, I wouldn't necessarily say that any one firm is probably ahead of another in terms of investment from a financial perspective. But I do think that a lot of us, particularly amongst the larger law firm cohort, and I do hasten to add that there are many different types of law firms with different client bases and, you know, different needs in different areas, I think that they could really be contributing here. But since I come from a law firm, I'll speak from that perspective. I think over the past several years, you know, we have seen that acceleration of understanding the power of technology and what it can bring to our organizations. But, you know, we are still relatively immature in the way we're implementing technology so far. And I think there are a number of factors that underlie some of that slowness. And that will continue to impede progress. And in fact, it's, I think, sitting within a law firm and being still a practicing lawyer, for me, I'm a little bit less concerned about access to data and access to technologies and tools per se, because when I look outside of this industry, I see amazing innovation relating to both of those two topics. So I know the capability exists outside of this industry. So then my question is, well, why is that capability not bleeding into legal? And I think, you know, unfortunately, part of that equation is very much the cultural challenges within law firms, because they're very short-term focused in terms of delivery of matters and receiving income and recognizing and extracting the profit up to the partners of those firms. And what that means is the concept of longer-term investment is very new, very foreign, and frankly, on its face, unappealing to a partner in the firm. The good news is that we have leadership teams now popping up in law firms like Asher's that are getting it. And that's not to say they fully understand the power of digital or data or technology, but they recognize now, and you know, because we're seeing it mirrored in our clients, they recognize that it's something really important that we need to be focused our attention on. But what they need are people to come into the organization and to help them understand what practical steps they can do to actually really start to shift and accelerate the pace of their ability to adopt some of these new technologies and to develop some of these capabilities. And that's, again, within a law firm organization, that's a multi-layered challenge, because you want to be simultaneously growing the business and revenue, developing new efficiencies and therefore hopefully improving profitability, looking at risk management and helping to bolster your capability to mitigate the risks going on. And I think fourthly, and this last limb, I think is the limb that's really rising to the surface now in the post-COVID world. It's really changing the employee and client experience, because we have really, gone a long way in terms of digitalizing experiences. And in law firms, there's a serious incongruity between the day-to-day activities of a lawyer, the way they interact with digital, with data, and what they see outside of their firm, and what they see law firms promising they can do for clients. And that incongruity, I think, for so long as that gap remains very wide, will be a big hindrance, because what it means is that the lawyers and the people internal in the firm will not buy in to the need and the value and the requirement for them to culturally change a bit and adopt new ways of working, because there's, for them, what we're saying we can do externally is all, pie in the sky thinking, a lot of fluffy talk, but no real action, because they're not feeling themselves the power of digital and data. And so we really need to, I think, start internally and change the way our employees and our lawyers are interacting with digital and data, and demonstrating incrementally the value of small changes and small uplifts in terms of what we do. Now, the flip side of that is that technologically, that means within a law firm, there's a lot that needs to change, because many law firms are still quite old school in their IT infrastructure, the capabilities. And so that's where then we start to look at companies like regulation and the ability to actually not worry about having to share our data, because that is the scariest thing a law firm can think about. The movement of data outside of our controlled environment is absolutely the last thing we ever want to happen, because we're very, very concerned about our reputation and the sanctity of our clients' data. So these concepts now around access as opposed to sharing becomes really important. Programs like the Law Tech Sandbox, where we can play and experiment in safe environments, becomes really important. And I think ultimately it's really driving that cross-industry collaboration, because we need to learn as an industry how to do data well, how to do data right, how to do data in a way that gives us value as an industry as a whole, not only individually. And I think what's really great about the digital data discussion is that, frankly, what's good for the industry is good for every law firm individually. So for me, I think it's a very easy conversation. That's not to say I'm winning hearts and minds every single day, but that's my job. That's what I need to be going out and doing and say, listen, let's start small. Let's experiment in this small space. Here internally, data never leaves our firewalls. We can see the value just for ourselves and an organization. It's like, now think about how we could explain that capability to a client and what it can bring to them. And when you explain it very simply, people's eyes light up. You know, I have people in our general counsel's office being like, oh, so we could know what our standard positions are around some of our own contracts and then improve our templates and standard forms and make it easier for us to be negotiating all of these things day in and day out that my team is pushing, throwing them, you know, technology contracts saying we need to agree these. And they recognize it. It's actually, if you can explain it well, you know, in a way that the audience understands, they'll get it. And then what's really the key is then you have to show them. It can't just be talk. It can't just be concepts. You have to show them. And I think that's the part where, you know, again, it requires that investment of time, resource, some money, getting comfortable with bringing in some earlier stage companies that you're less used to working with as opposed to the sort of IT industry stalwarts, and really coming together and say, let's try to do something a little bit different, and let's do that in a safe space.
I interact with a lot of in-house companies, so just give the flip side of the in-house perspective. I think what Tara just mentioned there is the culture, and I think yes, there is the culture that then translates into a business model risk that needs to be addressed. But then there is the culture of lawyers themselves. Lawyers are trained to look at risk. We're not trained to look at opportunity, and by definition, we're not early adopters either. So you've got a human cultural barrier to overcome. And then if you look at the in-house community, well, the in-house community is under continuous budget. It's like, be more efficient, cut your resources. And they don't really have, again, talking about organizational challenges, they don't really have the ability to or the space, the headspace, the budget space, the resource space to be able to explore new ways of doing things without being under pressure. So, and this is, I think, what you're tackling, Jennifer, is let's educate the whole industry about the fact that some organizational changes need to be done so that we can enable law tech across the whole industry. Because at the end of the day, a law firm's client data is not their data, it is their client's data. So their clients have to be on board with the journey too.
I think there's two things just to mention there. One is around understanding the value. And I think this is something that unless you've been exposed to, you know, great uses of data and you've had the benefit of it and you've seen what's possible, it's hard to put yourself into a space where you can start thinking about that. So I think that's one of the things that's really important about getting people together and just talking about this stuff, demoing it and sharing examples of successes and failures. It's like, oh, I have changed my workflow management tool and now I get all this data that means I can actually plan, I can do resourcing better. I can look at where I need to introduce self-service models. You know, lots of in-house teams start there. So I think there's that part about coming together and going, well, actually, why don't we just have a go at this together? And then it's no one person standing alone. It's a collective experiment. You're being responsible, but you're not sort of pretending that you know everything or concerned that if you go out on your own, you're going to be betting the farm and it's just you. And actually, we've seen that come through in some of the collaboration we've done already.
And that word comes through time and time again. And I suppose I reiterate, Tara, it does seem to me that Ashurst is way ahead of so many other law firms based on what you said and how you're approaching it. But there's a common theme here, which is around collaboration. Sally, you were talking about, you know, collaboration on the analytics side. Tori, you were talking about internal collaboration within a firm. And Jennifer, particularly, you were talking about collaboration amongst bringing regulators and those actors that are in the space are coming together. And that seems to be absolutely critical. What would you say are the biggest blocks to effective collaboration? Jennifer, what's stopping the collaboration from really coming to the fore?
Do you know, I would say the number one reason people don't come, in my actual personal experience, is time. people are so busy.
I give you an example.
We've been pulling a data set together for one of the pioneers in the sandbox currently. And that we've got a whole amazing network wrapped around this. We call them the Avengers. So we're Avengers Assemble. So we tap up these cape wearing heroes, right? And we say, hey, you know, this tech needs this. Are you interested in collaborating? Loads of people say yes. But when it actually comes to pulling things together, it's hard to find the time off the side of your desk. My personal view is that this has got a lot worse during COVID. I think during lockdown, people are working crazy hours, particularly the general counsel community. It is out of control. So I think number one, time. Now, of course, with time always comes prioritization. So that's also about understanding. If you understand the strategic value, then you will elevate something above what might currently be on your desk that is in the very urgent but not so strategically important category. So I think there's a sort of storytelling and strategic piece that's important to it. The other thing, of course, is competition. And of course, it's appropriate that businesses are trying to make money, trying to get ahead, etc. But where are their vested interests that actually are either inappropriately emphasized or holding things back? So, you know, I asked, what is our sort of medical research example for law? You know, if we were to come together and pool insights, what would that result in? I'll give you another example. We've been sourcing data, particular contracts from different sources, and the people that have shared them, they've obviously been shared with us anonymously, and they've said, please only use them for this particular purpose. And we're very concerned about our IP. But when you look at the documents, they are almost identical. So isn't that interesting, right? That there's a lot of, I call it fake bespoke. Right. So what does that mean then? If we were to come together and just be left with what is really valuable, and then there's a whole load of other stuff that we can actually share and we don't need to worry about, and it's not going to be commercially disadvantageous. So I would raise those two things. There are probably more, Mark, but I'll just start there.
Amazing. And perhaps, Tara, if I turn to you, one of the challenges internally around certainly the discussions I've had is collaboration takes time, which is non-billable, and often leads to greater efficiency, which reduces billable hours. So what's in it for a partner with a very high billable hours target and a finance director who's calling the partners every month saying, come on, you lot, you haven't issued enough invoices. Is that an impediment to collaboration, or am I being too cynical?
Not at all. I think in terms of cosmetically, you would say, well, what, you know, a partner would say, why on earth would I want to automate what I do when I can charge my people out based on the hours they bill? I want the maximum number of people and the maximum number of hours. The simple truth is very few types of legal work being done gets charged on an hourly rates basis, notwithstanding the fact that all the financial systems use that as its core. We're all doing fixed and cap fee work. So if that's your practice where you are constantly under that fee pressure, the automation of tasks, the improvement of efficiencies and how things get done, the addition of different types of resources, some which may be lower cost, will absolutely enhance everything about your practice. And I think what's really important within a law firm is you need to find that coalition of the willing, find the partners who understand there's an opportunity here for me because I'm under tremendous fee pressure to not only get the work done and be able to make money on it, but to differentiate myself for my clients and show them something different about the way Ashurst does something. And that's actually the approach that Ashurst Advance has taken. We very slowly are working through the different partners and helping them to build up their practices. And ultimately, you know, my goal is I just want to create FOMO throughout the entirety of the firm, do something really cool, be able to show those metrics. And that's really important. You know, and Jennifer mentioned the value point. You have to be able to tangibly explain the benefits and the value that someone derived, and in a way that, you know, frankly speaks to the ego of an individual partner in a law firm. You absolutely have to get to that level. But if you can start showing those numbers and then showing this partner and that partner and that partner, we've done it in different practices. So suddenly people's creativity sparks up and they say, oh, I could see maybe that could be useful for the type of work I do. They don't have to accept, you know, the proposition that my work is actually just the same as that person's work, except I say I do it for this industry versus that industry. So again, you keep their ego intact and their specialness intact, but what you're really doing is very slowly helping them to realize that they can do so much more work that's so much more profitable, and that frankly, and we get this feedback from clients all the time, that is different than what clients are hearing from all of their law firms. And all of us are trying to get a bit more into the space and design new solutions that provide higher levels of automation and efficiencies. So it's not to say that any one law firm is necessarily doing anything purely unique. But certainly, I think when you can demonstrate a creativity and flexibility in your approach of how to work with the client and really understand from their perspective, they also want to keep their costs as low as possible. They want to shift the grunt work and the manual labor away from them as much as possible so they can be value centers within their own organizations. When we demonstrate we understand that and we actually have a means of constructing a solution that works for them, that blows clients away. And that's exactly what they're now starting to look for and, in fact, demanding. And that's why teams like ours are in a lot of the major law firms now and are growing and pervading. And we're seeing new individual businesses popping up, focusing just on this kind of new law space because the demand from the clients is coming through.
And Sally, imagine a world in which all of the law firms not only had Atara driving this innovation and collaboration internally, but actually perhaps had somebody driving collaboration amongst the law firms themselves in the best interest of the sector. Is that too far-fetched, or do you think organizations might be able to help with that sharing of data in a way that isn't sensitive or the data might be prejudiced for clients?
So I'm gonna say something that is paradoxical potentially for this talk and a bit radical. We actually don't believe in the sharing of data. We believe in the sharing of insight. You don't actually need to share your data, because if you share your data, you lose control of that data. I think you need to share the approach, you need to share the playbook. And I think that's actually what the industry suffers of the most, is that legal has not had to do innovation for a very, very long time. And there is no innovation playbook. So I think the playbook is being built one organization at a time. I think if we could all come together and we have established a think tank, and Tara and other law firms are on that think tank. So we've got Ashurst, Clifford Chance, Norton Rose. We've got in-house, but I don't think I can mention who that is, but it's a large bank, and DWF. And obviously there's always a seat for Tech Nation for Jennifer, but we're mindful of not duplicating work. But the idea there is to share what that playbook for collaboration would look like and what the playbook for innovation would look like and, you know, what the benefits of collaboration are for everybody, for the industry. We're still not saying, come on, everybody share their data, put it centrally somewhere, because we're saying don't share data. So I'm really hopeful that, you know, that world will exist.
And Mark, just a thought that jumps off what Tara and Sally have said around, you know, client-driven demand and then the why of getting on with it. It feels like there's a piece here around leadership and what actually is leadership for the next generation of legal services. So we know what leadership has been to date. And that's worked and it's been very profitable. And we're in this sort of transition phase. And I think that's the case societally as well on a global level. There's a real shift happening in emphasis of what people want, how they want to spend their money, the brands that they want to align with, the integrity that they feel is important. People are increasingly, voting with their feet in respect of integrity. And you hear people talking about that all the time now, just like regular conversations in the post office, in the street or whatever, that's very much to the fore. And I think the The way that's precipitating into business is through the ESG agenda, the environmental, social and governance agenda. And that, I think, is going to bite. It's going to be something that law firm leadership is going to have to get their arms around, not in a sort of innovation by press release way, but in a meaningful way. And so I think there's a piece here around leadership and who is going to lead and who's going to take that forward and take the chances alongside that leadership requires. And one thing which I think is a bit of a carrot in respect of that is if you look at, I mean, open banking is an obvious analog for this, although it was led by legislation and for different reasons, but that was all about data portability for consumers. But that has resulted in an 18 billion estimate value increase to the UK economy, 17,000 new jobs, etc. It feels like we sometimes think about the problems and not about the opportunities. Somebody once told me this old story about a person walking through a forest holding moldy peanuts and refusing to throw them away and just focusing on the moldy peanuts. What they didn't realize was if they just threw the damn moldy peanuts away, around the corner in the clearing was a feast. And that's, I think, the other side to this is where are we placing our emphasis? What does leadership look like in this?
So I think that's brilliantly well said. And in conversations with general counsel, it does seem to me that there are four disintermediating factors at the moment which are pushing the traditional law firms away from the client. The obvious one, to my mind at least, is the big four accountancy firms. I think they're still big four. I'm never too sure if it's big four, big five. I think it's big four. Because I'm told that the largest law practices in the world are now within the accountancy firms. And I'm told anecdotally that they're much better at analysing internally data than your classical law firm. Although, Tara, from what you're saying, that doesn't seem like too ambitious a goal to aim for. We've then got the neo firms, the Keystones and others, which have a longer term view because they don't have, as Tara pointed out, that short termism that some of the classical law firm partners have. They have a longer investment cycle to them. The litigation funders seem to be eating a lot of the work for the traditional litigation arbitration teams because their interests tend to be more aligned to the CFO than to the general counsel. But the last disintermediator, people keep telling me, is technology. You know, it's disintermediating the classical law firm because buying risk reports on a technology basis is significantly cheaper than asking a law firm to do a review of 20 countries' amendments to their legislation. So my question to each of you is, if law firms are going to stay relevant to their clients, what's going to drive the change? We've heard that it might be, you know, the client. So wait until the client demands it, then implement it. That seems to be an approach that law firms have taken with due diligence. You know, they still want to fill the data room with trainees until the client says they won't pay for them. And suddenly AI data review comes to the fore. So will it be the client? Will it be the market? And the fact that there's disintermediation going on, a law firm's going to have the vision to say, no, the market is eating our breakfast. We must change before the clients take the work away. Will it be cultural change in the firms? Will the partners have an epiphany and realize that this is an absolutely critical thing to do? Or perhaps some might say more frighteningly, some might encourage it. Should the regulator step in and require that shared playbook and start to impose obligations on law firms to be perhaps more efficient and embrace technology? So if I'll start with you, Sally, which of those do you think will be most likely to drive implementation and change?
Technology, but I'm biased. but let me give you the reason why I think that. I think there's an article, forgive me, I can't remember the name of the writer, asking what the contract of your future will be is the wrong question. And there's an analogy with the horse. The question really is, in the case of the horse, it was what's the next mode of transportation going to be, which ended up being the car, the airplane, whatever it's going to be next. A contract is not actually a contract. It's not the written document that's the contract. It is the agreement between the parties that then gets documented in the contract. I'm not saying that the contract is going to disappear, especially not the complex ones. But if you take a look at what's happening in the Web 3.0 space, so Web 3.0 is fully about decentralization and about full automation, and it's completely open and open source and collaborative, and it's all about allowing people to work from wherever they are, earn an income wherever they are, and live well wherever they are. And that's also part of the movement that Jennifer was talking about, which is ESG. There is no need for contracts and those kinds of technology platforms because it's all completely automated. So when you start to see those then platforms starting to connect with each other and everything starting to disintermediate, I think that's an irreversible movement. And technology, it is very well known that technology moves exponentially, whereas everything else moves, much, much slower. So it's a mathematical reason why I'm saying that technology will be the driver.
That's brilliant. Technology to the fore, leading the way rather than being the tail on the proverbial dog. Tara, what do you think?
I would actually say it's probably a little bit of a few different factors, but I think ultimately there won't be success in terms of change happening within law firms until the culture changes. So I actually believe very strongly, digital, and that's not just technology and tools, that's digital, which is mindsets, skill sets, capability. Injecting that within law firms is critical, but they need to be injected in a way that allows the culture to shift along with it. And within Asher's, I'm working on our digital strategy right now with our CTO, and we're very focused on all of the different things that need to happen in order to actually create digital DNA within our firm, where digital pervades every aspect of what we do. And that really changes the experience that people have. And that allows us to, in turn, create better experiences for our clients. And we, our team, being an innovation-led team, do a lot of client engagement. And actually, we've been reassured that our clients will always pick up the phone to us when they have that tough legal question. We are their legal advisors, and that's why they come to us. But there's a lot of space around that they are not being well served in. They are just inundated and overloaded with information and change. And they don't have anyone yet that's actually cutting through that noise and giving them the information, in the moment, that's very specific to them that they need to know. No one's doing that well. It's a huge challenge. It's a very complicated, difficult thing to do. But we are really focused on all of those other digital capabilities that we could develop for the firm that would empower our people to start to tackle some of those other problems that we know our clients have. And I think that, that in turn just drives business, hopefully drives better experiences and client engagement, which changes hearts and minds. So I think at the core, there has to be the cultural change. If the cultural change doesn't happen, it's not going to be an epiphany. It will need to be imposed in as light touched, but top down and bottom up way within every firm, and then all the other, all the other elements will form part of that. But it's more than just the technology, and it's more than just the fear. And actually, I really try to stay away from talking about the fear of what's happening, because it should actually be looked at as all opportunity.
And that ties in beautifully, Jennifer. And if I may say, you have the final word on this. To your point about focus on the opportunity, not the moldy peanuts.
Absolutely. We don't need the moldy peanuts. And this may be one of those questions where all answers are paradoxically the same answer. And perhaps that's why you asked it. And for me, the answer to change is always people. It's a very one person by one person at a time, people changing their behavior, small change every day, saying no to this, yes to that. That's the only way that things actually move. I think what you said about the regulators is a really interesting thought experiment. My sense is, in relation to the big law end of the market, that the driver would need to be competition. So public interest and competition. So is it that the regulators are likely to see there's a market failure there and move in if the clients are happy to pay? And for the time being, the clients are happy to pay. The mass market opportunity, I think, for regulators is much more keen. And what we've seen at LawTech UK is an 11.6 billion a year unserved market for consumers and SMEs, small to medium-sized businesses. Now, that's not even people who are currently served but ill-served. That's people who want to be served and are not served at all. So I would see that market as a huge opportunity in respect of regulator and increased focus and market innovation. But ultimately, I think the driver comes from the money, really. So yes, I agree with what Sally said in respect of technology. And we saw what happened when we all got iPhones, right? We started changing how we physically move. I mean, swipe left was never a thing, right? And then suddenly everyone's swiping left. What will be the equivalent of that in legal services? You weren't expecting that analogy. But ultimately, the money will drive it. So, you know, the boardroom, if the board need data, if we bring it back to data, if the board need data, the board needs certain level of risk awareness from their counsel, who are the ones that pay the outside counsel, then that is what will precipitate change. And whoever delivers on that is the one who will, be able to throw the moldy peanuts away.
Well, I'm not sure if swiping left or right is the best one to do, but I'd certainly like to swipe in one direction on an absolutely fabulous conversation. We've mentioned FOMO, we've mentioned some fabulous things like fake bespoke. We've spoken about not sharing data, but sharing insights. It's been absolutely wonderful, wonderful conversation. I'd like to thank Jennifer, Tara and Sally for their time and sharing their insights today for the AIFC Legal Tech podcast. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been really, really good conversation. Thanks
great
for moderating.
Thanks
for having us.
Yep. Yeah.
This podcast is being produced by the Astana International Financial Centre and moderated by the chairman of the AIFC Law Tech Advisory Council, Mark Beer. Thank you very much for listening. If you would like to hear more information on the Astana International Financial Centre's Law Tech Advisory Council, please follow us on LinkedIn.